NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the New York Heat Act has been reintroduced in the New York State Senate. It passed the Senate last year, but wasn't brought to the floor in the State Assembly. Advocates rallied in Albany last week to push for its passage. We'll get the latest on the bill that would help the state transition away from fossil fuels. Just in time for Valentine's Day, local romance cover novelist Sharon Spiak has a new exhibit, The Story of a True Romance. We'll learn more about her romance covers and the exhibit later. Health and wellness columnist Maggie Fitzpatrick is here and says, don't rush results. And Tapping into Black History, the Cat's Cast podcast, explores the legacy of Clayton Pegleg Bates. That's coming up right after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Jordan's King Abdullah will visit the White House this morning. His meeting with President Trump is highly anticipated. Trump has demanded that Jordan and Egypt accept all Palestinians now living in Gaza, a suggestion both countries have rejected. Yesterday, Trump insisted that all hostages held in Gaza be returned to Israel by Saturday. Otherwise, he said, quote, all hell is going to break out. Hamas has delayed this weekend's release of three hostages, as stipulated in the ceasefire deal, NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
Trump made the comments in the Oval Office while speaking to reporters, but didn't specify what that threat meant or how it would work. He called for the ceasefire to be canceled by noon Saturday if all hostages were not released by Hamas, but also said that Israel could, quote, override it. The fragile ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas, which the U.S., including members from Trump's administration, helped broker, calls for Israeli hostages to be released over the course of several weeks in exchange for Palestinian prisoners and detainees each time. Hamas had said it will delay the release of more hostages, quote, until further notice, accusing Israel of violating the ceasefire agreement. Israel has said it has placed its troops in Gaza on heightened alert. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
An independent research arm that is based in the U.S. Education Department has essentially been shut down. The Trump administration is cutting off the Institute of Education Sciences, or IES. NPR's Janaki Mehta says the cuts threaten vital programs like this one, used in classrooms to help children learn.
There's some high-quality digital tools that are already being used in classrooms in many states to measure how kids can make up ground in math. It's part of a study that IES was conducting, and now that that contract is canceled, the study is going to be cut short and the tools could soon be pulled from classrooms.
NPR's Janaki Mehta reporting. Stocks opened lower this morning as U.S. trading partners are promising to retaliate for President Trump's new tariffs. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 100 points in early trading.
The European Union says the president's new 25% taxes on imported steel and aluminum will not go unanswered. EU leader Ursula von der Leyen says the trading bloc will push back with tariffs of its own on U.S. exports in order to protect European workers, businesses, and consumers. The trade battle is a rerun of the one fought the last time Trump imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Economists say those measures wound up costing U.S. manufacturing jobs. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell is testifying before a Senate committee today. Powell has signaled the central bank is in no hurry to make further cuts to interest rates. Inflation remains somewhat higher than the Fed would like, while the unemployment rate is still very low. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 87 points. The Nasdaq is down 43. This is NPR. Pope Francis has rebuked the Trump administration's plans to conduct mass deportations of migrants who are in the United States illegally. The pontiff sent a letter to U.S. bishops. In it, Francis writes that forcibly removing people based on their documented status strips them of inherent dignity. And the Pope says this, quote, will end badly. The letter also disagrees with Vice President Vance's theological view of deportation. Vance is a Roman Catholic. President Trump has signed an executive order on plastic straws. As NPR's Jacob Fenston tells us, it rolls back a plan by former President Joe Biden to cut down plastic pollution.
Trump says we're going, quote, back to plastic. On Truth Social, he complained about paper straws that disgustingly dissolve in your mouth. He says the government will no longer buy paper straws or provide them in federal buildings. Activist Jackie Nunez is founder of the Last Plastic Straw campaign. She says Trump isn't the first to hate on biodegradable paper straws, but she welcomes the renewed spotlight on single-use plastics.
You know, when we use plastic straws, we're literally drinking in plastic particles and chemicals.
Biden's policy would have phased out the purchasing of single-use plastics by the federal government starting in 2027. Jacob Fenston, NPR News.
A powerful winter storm is headed for the central and eastern U.S. The National Weather Service says winter storm warnings and advisories spread from Colorado to Delaware. Some areas will get a lot of snow in the coming days. Others are going to get significant ice accumulation. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Nearly 30 lawmakers and hundreds of advocates from across New York State rallied in Albany last week to urge the Assembly to pass the New York Home Energy Affordable Transition Act, or the New York HEAT Act, as you may know it. The legislation, designed to address the state's escalating energy affordability and climate crisis, promises to lower energy bills for struggling households and accelerate the state's shift to clean energy. The New York HEAT Act has garnered broad support from environmental advocates, community leaders, and lawmakers, many of whom have been calling for its passage for months. Michael Hernandez is with Rewiring America, the nonprofit working to electrify homes, businesses, and communities, and he joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Thank you for being here. And can we just explain to folks who may not know about the New York HEAT Act what those main goals are? I briefly summarized them in the introduction there, and how it will impact New Yorkers facing high energy bills.
Absolutely. I think number one is the New York HEAT Act would cap household energy burdens at 6% of their household income. So this way, it requires the Public Service Commission to start a proceeding and to determine how can we set up our rates, how can we move forward with ensuring that households are not being overly burdened. Also, it modifies the existing law so that there's no longer what's called the 100-foot rule, which basically says that if you're within 100 feet of the existing gas infrastructure, you can request the expansion of that infrastructure, and all the ratepayers have to contribute to, or gas ratepayers have to pay for that expansion. So it's not the building developers or the utilities that pay for that. That goes right onto the customer bills. And then lastly, it's the obligation to serve. Right now in New York State, there's no discretion. Basically, when utilities and the commission are the Public Service Commission are considering, what do we do with these old leak-prone pipes? What do we do with the future? Can we put in a thermal energy network, or can we electrify those homes? The law right now requires that we replace old leak-prone gas pipes with new gas pipes, and that's driving up costs for gas customers. And in fact, gas is at a low right now from where it's been in the last couple of years, and we're looking at 20% increases on gas customer bills because of the cost of maintaining this old gas infrastructure. So the New York HEAT Act would resolve all of those issues.
Now, the HEAT Act passed in the New York State Senate last year, but wasn't brought to the floor in the State Assembly. It's been reintroduced in the New York State Senate. I mentioned the folks who rallied in Albany last week. Do you think there's been a shift in the legislature, and do you see that it might have a better chance of passing this time around?
Absolutely. I think energy bills are getting very high. The governor and the Speaker of the Assembly have stressed how important it is to give people a break on their energy bills. And this is clearly an important law that would move us away from this antiquated old gas system that is really causing issue, high energy bills for customers. And so moving away from that, electrifying homes where you will see a drastic, significant decrease in your energy bills is imperative. And so I think we see a lot of support in the Assembly Majority Conference, and I just think the time has come for that transition to happen.
Let's talk a little bit about those rising energy costs and the details there. The rising energy costs have affected over a million families in the state. One in seven households in New York have fallen behind on energy bills. With this act, it caps those bills at 6% of household income. How do you think this provision and this act is going to impact families struggling to pay their energy bills?
It would bring immediate relief. I think, you know, we would see the commission would be tasked to look at the rates. Currently, the way that the rates are structured is very regressive. So the first three therms that households purchase each month, a therm is a unit of gas. Each month, the first three therms that you pay are the most expensive therms, and most on average, an average household will use approximately 60 therms to 100 therms a month, depending upon the size of the house. And so, actually, you see that as you consume more gas, the rates actually go down. So that it's actually incentivizing more consumption of gas than and actually making everybody pay a lot more for those first three therms means that everybody, no matter how little gas you consume, you use, you are paying a hefty price for the delivery charges for the gas system. So New York Heat would say, let's rework those rates so that those smaller households, those low-income households, are not paying such a hefty fee for the delivery fees.
There are several business leaders who continue to push back against the New York Heat Act. What do you say to those folks who are pushing back on this this regulation, this law that would redirect investments and contribute to the economic and environmental benefits for New Yorkers?
Oh, I think once people see and experience for themselves how much better it is to be electrified, to have a heat pump. Now, what's interesting about heat pumps is that they warm your house in the winter, and the modern cold climate heat pumps are very effective in all of New York's climates, but they also cool in the summer. So when you install a heat pump, you get both heating and cooling, and then they're far more efficient than fossil fuel combustion systems. And so you'll use far less energy when you install those heat pumps. Also, generally with heat pump installation, they'll do weatherization, insulation in your home so that you're using far less energy and you're much more comfortable. So I think people will see, that this is just great. You're using less energy, you're feeling more comfortable, and your energy bills are going down. It's a win-win, and we're not having to pay the cost to support the gas infrastructure.
In addition to business leaders who are saying that New York Heat Act would negatively impact New York businesses and the ability to attract new ones, some state senators are saying that limited cap, that 6% cap on income, would get passed on to middle-class rate-paying New Yorkers, that they would be the ones who would be getting that bill, basically. What is your response to that?
That is a complete misunderstanding of the provisions of the bill. The 6% cap does not shift costs to other rate payers or other classes of rate payers. As I said, the current structure of the rate of the gas rate is regressive. So it actually shifts costs to smaller, lower-income households, they're actually paying a much larger percentage of their income than you see for, so this would actually just make it more equitable, so that those smaller, lower-income households are not paying such a high percentage of their households. And also, I'll just mention that the 6% goal target, which it currently exists as a part of the commission's order that was enacted in 2016, that applies in the New York HEAT Act, the 6% applies to all households. So it's not just the low-income or moderate income households, it's all households that would not pay more than 6% of their household income.
How does the New York HEAT Act reflect the state's commitment to tackling climate change and energy affordability, especially after the challenges posed by the Trump administration's policies?
Well, that's a real good benefit of the New York HEAT Act. Not only does it bring down energy costs and provide us with really great heating and cooling systems within our homes, but it also reduces our greenhouse gas emissions significantly. If you look at New York's greenhouse gas emissions, the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions is from the building sector. So it's actually how we heat our space, how we heat our water, that contributes the most to New York's greenhouse gas emissions. So through electrifying those buildings, not only are we saving money and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, but we're also averting health costs associated with fossil fuel combustion and climate damage. So we're saving a significant amount of money avoiding climate crisis as well as the health impacts.
What are the next steps for the New York HEAT Act? As I mentioned, it's been reintroduced in the Senate. Is there a timeline here, or, you know, we know it's Albany, so it could get stuck, but what do you think might happen here?
So what I think is going to happen is that we're in the last few years, we've seen the New York State Senate include the HEAT Act in their One House budget proposal, which comes out in mid-March. And we are really advocating that the Assembly also include the full New York HEAT Act in its One House budget proposal. Both of those One House budget proposals will come out in mid-March. And so we want to see both houses incorporate that into their budget proposals and that it be New York HEAT be included in the final enacted budget that is statutorily required to be passed by April 1st of the year.
And how can citizens, concerned citizens who might be listening, continue to push for its passage?
Certainly call your assembly members, talk to the Speaker of the Assembly. They are the ones that for the last few years have not moved forward with enacting the New York HEAT Act and have been the cause of its stalling. We got very close last year, and we just need to continue to push that momentum to have the Assembly get on board and help us to transition to more affordable heating bills.
Any message for lawmakers who have yet to support it?
Listen to your constituents. Heating bills are far too high, and we need to provide some real remedies and real relief to these households. And the New York HEAT Act will bring that affordability to our constituents, to our households, to our families. The time to act is now. It's needed now more than ever, and it's urgent.
That's Michael Hernandez of Rewiring America talking about the New York HEAT Act designed to address the state's escalating energy affordability and climate crisis. It promises to lower energy bills for struggling households and accelerate the state's shift to clean energy. Michael Hernandez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn more about Clayton Pegleg Bates. It's the latest episode of Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
I'm Kuzan Grace, KG, doing African American history during the month of February. Black History Month was originally created to fight ignorance and to prevent the continuation of misconception about black people and their history. So I'll be doing presentations on black history from then until now. So please check me out Tuesday on The Music Emporium.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In the latest episode of Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast, it's an excerpt from a live episode that was recorded at the Emerson Resort and Spa in November of 2024. Host Brett Berry is engaging in a detailed discussion with Eleanor Levy, the Folk Arts Program Manager at Arts Mid-Hudson, about the life and legacy of Clayton Pegleg Bates. The show explores Bates' inspiring journey from losing a leg in a cotton gin accident at the age of 12 to becoming one of the most celebrated tap dancers performing on Broadway and appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show at least 21 times. Joining us now is host and producer of Cat's Cast, Brett Berry. Brett, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. Wow. I mean, let's talk about the legacy of Clayton Pegleg Bates. You always find such interesting stories. How did this one come about?
Well, you may have spotted this too, Tim. There's a sign on Route 209 between Kingston and Ellenville, which says it's that stretch of highway is the Pegleg Bates Memorial Highway. And I've passed it many times and wondered who this was. Had no idea. And started doing some research. And it turns out that he was this very famous tap dancer who, as you said, had multiple appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show, was in all kinds of shows in the New York area, and eventually created a black resort in Kerhonkson. And people would come up to meet him because he was very famous, and also come up because it was a safe place to be in a time when that wasn't necessarily the case.
Yeah, I seen that sign too. I thought it was a congressman or something. This is amazing that he turned this tragedy into this. He was one of the most celebrated tap dancers ever.
Yeah, and he lost his leg at age 12. His uncle made him a peg leg out of wood, and he decided, I'm going to be a tap dancer. And he used that peg leg as part of his act. And in a way that a two-legged tap dancer obviously couldn't, using it for this kind of percussiveness and the way that he blended it with the rhythm and the music gave the act something really special. So it was not like a freak show type thing. It was legitimate, very talented tap dancing in a different way.
I mentioned this is a live episode that was recorded last November. Do you have other live episodes planned?
We do one every maybe year. I'm not sure what the next one's going to be yet, but I would love to do another live show. They're a lot of fun. So yeah, we recorded this in November at the Emerson Resort and Spa with a live audience, which gave us the ability to take questions and get audience feedback, and even some people in the audience who had met Pegleg and recounted some stories about that. The piece that you're going to play today is abbreviated, so we might not get some of that. But the live element does add some interesting details that you can't get on such a produced show. So hopefully we'll do another one soon.
All right, let's take a listen. It's Brett Berry and Eleanor Levy, Folk Arts Program Manager at Arts Mid-Hudson, tapping into Black history, the life and legacy of Clayton Pegleg Bates. Thank you, Brett.
Thanks, Sam. Enjoy.
The story of Peg Leg Bates might have started just over 100 years ago when Clayton Bates lost a leg in a farming accident. But the Cat's Cast angle started earlier this year when our neighbors Kathleen and Boyd joined us for an interpretive tour of the Amistad, docked at the Rondout. Driving back home, we passed a sign on Route 209 that we've probably all passed many times, and it reads, Peg Leg Bates Memorial Highway. And Kathleen said something like,
Hey, who's that?
So the research began. Born October 11th, 1907, in a small South Carolina town, Clayton Bates took to dancing at age 5 and lost a leg at age 12 in a cotton gin. 3 years later, his uncle fashioned him a peg leg. And then Peg Leg Bates launched his career on the black vaudeville circuit. By 20, he was on Broadway with what the New York Times called an energetic blend of soft shoe, tap, and jitterbug. In fact, he would become one of the greatest tap dancers of all time. The Ed Sullivan Show featured him at least 21 times. Here's a clip.
We're here with dancing star Peg Leg Bates. So let's welcome him back warmly with a really big hand.
Arts Mid-Hudson in Poughkeepsie recently hosted the exhibit Peg Leg Bates, The Performance Years, and Eleanor Levy was at the helm of that show. Eleanor, how did you come to discover Peg Leg Bates?
Well, I first have to say I grew up in Oakland, California, so I knew nothing. All I knew of the Catskills was, of course, Dirty Dancing. And I certainly didn't know about Peg Leg Bates. I started work at Arts Mid-Hudson in 2016. And about a month or so later, I met Jeff Miller, Ulster County historian. And once we got to know each other and he sort of got to know my work, he came to me and he said, look, there's this person I've really wanted to research and study, but I just don't know how to go about it, how to get started. And like, okay. He said, it's a man named Clayton Peg Leg Bates, who is a one-legged African-American tap dancer. And that's all he had to say to me. And I was in. He had actually met Peg Leg Bates. Jeff had been a teacher in the school district around Kingston. So he had first encountered Peg Leg Bates during one of the shows that Peg Leg Bates would do in the schools. And that sort of sparked his interest, and that kept going. And once he told me about him, and I did some more research, I was like, we have to. Then Dave Davidson came in. Dave Davidson of Hudson West Productions made the documentary called Dancing Man that actually we got to see last week at the Borscht Belt Film Festival about Peg Leg Bates, and had known Peg Leg Bates sort of towards the end of his life. And that sort of got the ball rolling. And the true product is the webpage. If you go to artsmidhudson.org and go to the folk arts page, you can link to the webpage about Peg Leg Bates. But I also was able to access many of the posters that featured him in the shows that he did around the world. And so that's what we did for the exhibit. We had copies of the posters. He actually performed with the Harlem Globetrotters. Among other people, he performed in Australia. He performed before royalty in England. I mean, he really made it, you know, lots and lots of places before coming home.
You mentioned Dave Davidson, who produced a documentary called The Dancing Man, and he gave us permission to use this clip from his film. So I'm going to play that now.
Don't look at me in sympathy. I'm glad that I'm this way, for I feel good and I'm knocking on wood as long as I can sing. I mix light fantastics up with hot gymnastics. I'm Peg Leg Bates, the one-leg dancing man.
So what does that say about the man? He lost a leg and decided, I'm going to dance.
It's pretty amazing. And for those of you who are going to listen to this later and can't see what happened, A, you can go to the webpage and see the clip, but his signature move was actually landing on the peg leg, and which was really hard on his leg, hard on that leg. And he, you know, no two-legged tap dancer can emulate what he does because of the particular syncopation of, you know, the tapping with the foot and then with the peg leg. Although there is a one-legged tap dancer, Evan Ruggiero, who dances now, known as Lord Peg Leg, but it was the other leg. And I don't even think he's tried to replicate that move. You can correct me if I'm wrong, Evan. But it says it's so much about resilience that he didn't want to give up. And in a sense, proving to his mother, because he was born to sharecroppers, and he really wanted to bring in money and work in the cotton gin. And his mother said no, 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 and she prayed on it, and she said yes, which, of course, she immediately regretted when he lost his leg, which, by the way, they operated on the kitchen table, because, of course, he wasn't allowed in the hospital. And I think just from that early age, it's like, I'm going to make something of myself. I'm going to do what I need to do. And he did. And not only did he perform around the country, he also, you know, it was really hard on black performers then. You know, there was a specific booking agent that they could use. And of course, the green laws were in effect about where they could stay. And, black performers were not only not paid as well as white performers, they were often scammed out of their money. And he was scammed, I think, twice, and made a decision that wasn't going to happen. You know, he had to, at least once he had to call his mother for money, and he was like, I can't do that again. And she said, you can't do that again. So he really figured out how to save money. And he was a shrewd business person on top of that. In a time, I mean, still today, you know, we hear that it's hard for people of color in the music industry to get fair pay. And certainly back then it was a lot harder than that. And, you know, where they could stay. I think they were probably treated better in Europe and around the world than they were in their own home country. You know, the places they could stay, where they could perform, was always up for grabs. And, you know, having to leave town fast if necessary. And one of the most significant things to me that I'm still trying to research and having not a lot of luck is he went to perform in Washington, D.C., but blacks were not allowed to perform on the stage, so he had to wear blackface to cover the fact that he was black.
That's amazing. I read that he had performed in blackface, and I was scratching my head on that one. So
yeah, it was because he wasn't allowed on the stages. So
talk a little bit about how he was a pioneer in other ways, either for black entertainers or disabled entertainers, or just as a black businessman in that time period.
Well, certainly for black entertainers, and him taking control of his finances in that way and making sure that, you know, he didn't get rooked a second or third time, which was kind of significant. And he was a pretty strong character, you know, and certainly there weren't many disabled entertainers at that time at all, let alone a one-legged tap dancer. So that was pretty significant in itself. And then the decision to be an entrepreneur, and the story that goes with that is that he was performing at Grossinger's, and he was standing with another black performer or his brother. I can't quite remember that part, but he looks out of the audience and he turns to him and says, where are we? Basically, where are we? And he decided Peg Leg Bates decided he wanted to open an interracial resort, where anyone could come. And what's interesting is he opened this resort in what used to be a chicken farm or a turkey farm. And they renovated the buildings into cabins and things like that where people could stay. There were three ways to stay at the resort. You could come up for the week and stay all week, and apparently the food was really good. And you could come up for like a weekend. But I think the most significant thing, which did happen at some of the other resorts, is that dozens of buses would leave New York, I think Philadelphia, on Saturday and Sunday morning, and you would come up for the day. And for a small fee, you had the run of the place. I think there was trail rides, and there was, I don't think there were horses, but there was bikes, and there was hiking, and the pool, and people would party on the bus all the way up, and they would come out with their big coolers of food and stuff, and Peg Leg would come and come up in like his golf cart, and the women would line up. He was also very, very handsome, as you can see, and very, very confident, and the women would just line up to get pictures taken with him. At the end of the day, at like 5:30, he would do a floor show, and then they would get back on the buses and go back to the city. And I think that's incredibly significant that you could find a way for one day to be up in this beautiful area and get to meet and see Peg Leg Bates perform.
And at the Peg Leg Bates Country Club, guests were told, you will not be robbed, you will not be mugged. And signs were posted, and they warned, we have karate experts on the premises.
I don't think they did, but it was a safe place. It was a safe place, not just for people from New York City, because during the off-season, he and the band and Miss Renee Bailey would travel down south to drum up business. So people came from all over because it was a safe place to be. And there just weren't that many of them for the Black community. And then there was the nightclub. And it went through a number of name changes because every time he tried to settle on a name, oh, you can't use resort, you can't use casino, you can't use this, you can't use that. You could just come up for the night and just go to the nightclub. And you also, it was really great because it was another place. You never knew who was going to be there, who might show up, because he knew everyone and people would come up from the city and perform sort of off the cuff.
So the resort closes in 1987, the dwindling crowd attributed to a very good problem, integration. Blacks and whites vacationing in the same resorts, there wasn't quite the need for a Black resort. So what happened to the property, Eleanor?
It was after his wife Alice passed away, because she was really the business side of the equation. I think he lost interest, a little bit of oomph, because Alice was gone. And he did sell it to another couple. I think they were Jamaican, and they tried to run it, and it didn't quite work. And I think he took it back for a little while. Then ultimately it was sold to a woman who unfortunately was killed on the property during Hurricane Sandy when a tree fell on her.
Oh, wow.
Then I think it lay fallow for a long, long time. Most recently, it's been bought by someone who is supposed to be opening some sort of equestrian center.
He retired, so to speak, from show business in 1989, but continued to perform for audiences of children, the elderly, the disabled, and advocating.
Advocating that you can do anything you put your mind to.
Yeah.
Which is just amazing. One of my favorite stories that I heard from one of the gentlemen from at the church was actually, it's like a secondhand story, but he had a friend whose father lost his leg in, I believe, World War II, or maybe a little late in Korea or Vietnam. And Peg Leg would go visit him, and the son would sit on the steps, and he would listen to the two men talk, and then they would get up and dance. And that's the vision I always think of, you know, of him, of Peg Leg Bates and this other gentleman, each with their one leg and their peg legs dancing, you know.
Peg Leg died in 1998, and 2 years later, Governor George Pataki signed into law a bill, the renaming of a 35-mile stretch of U.S. Route 209 in Ulster County, the Peg Leg Bates Memorial Highway. So I think we've come full circle. I hope that answered your question, Kathleen, on who Peg Leg Bates is. I had to go through all of this just to satisfy that. All right. Well, I want to thank you, Eleanor Levy, so much. Thank you all for joining us for Cat's Cast's special live recording of our tribute to Clayton Peg Leg Bates. I'm Brett Barry. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks to Brett for that. And you can hear that full episode at catscast.com. And you can check out all of the episodes from Brett there as well. Quick break for us, and we're back with health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat, Maggie Fitzpatrick. This is Radio Chatskill.
everything that ever existed could have once been compressed into the single point.
On the next Radiolab, we journey back to the beginning of the universe and try to understand how it formed and how we got here with the help of poets. Do you even like poetry?
No, I generally dislike poetry.
The universe in verse. That's on the next Radiolab.
Wednesday at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Maggie Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat, and she joins us every Tuesday with a preview of what's in the column. Hello.
Hello.
And this column is called Don't Rush Results. And you share a personal experience with a hamstring injury in this column. Talk a little bit about the challenges you faced balancing this desire to return to playing softball and letting yourself heal.
Darn hamstrings, let me tell you. Those things, when they get hurt, they take a long time to heal. Big muscles, big timeline. I was writing about this because I am currently experiencing this struggle. And I was thinking about it in terms of other health goals, too. And I think it's a really common universal experience to just want things faster than they come.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Do you think that is the root cause of people's impatience when it comes to seeing fitness or recovery results?
I do think impatience is a big component of why we give up.
Why do you think we struggle with it so much?
I'm not
Tell
sure.
Us, Maggie.
Maybe just like the whole world is really built to encourage us to want things quickly, right? So that way we consume more. We could go down that whole rabbit hole. But I think that, you know, it applies to this as well, where you can't really consume fitness results. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So the same strategy in our brain doesn't exactly work. But I think we apply the same thought process of maybe if I just work harder, it'll happen faster, right? And that doesn't necessarily equal one another.
Right. Well, you were talking about not rushing results and the importance of that. And you mentioned that you're going through this struggle. How do you personally stay motivated by, you know, a slow process and a longer recovery than you would like or your mind would like?
Yes. Motivation is not always there. It's just not. And I think that's something that we have to come to expect, is that I cannot only do this when I feel motivated. And we talk about that a lot. And once we can accept that, we don't have to like it, but we do have to accept it. Then it makes it a little bit easier to realize that we have to do whatever action it is that we are supposed to do. So for me, it's my PT exercises. It's doing my workouts that are extremely modified that I don't like. It's my, you know, icing my leg, doing, you know, all of the resting types of things, which is really hard for me. Even though I don't want to do those things, when I accept the fact that if I do them, it'll help me get back to playing more quickly than if I don't do them, right? It makes me feel a little bit more settled in the fact that I can do it, right? And it's like, I just have to do this one thing. And then once that thing is done, now I just have to do this one thing, right? And breaking it down into smaller pieces, I think really helps as well. Because like I said, we're not always going to feel motivated, especially when we feel like we're failing, right? Whether or not we are actually failing, if we feel like we're not achieving the result in the amount of time that we want, then it feels like we're not doing good enough.
And you talk about this in the column about focusing too much on the end goal, and that can sometimes blind you to the progress that you're making. You talked a little bit about those small steps. So how can people start to recognize small victories along the way?
I think it's important that we pay attention to different factors, right? So we can't just pay attention to how long did it take me to accomplish this goal all the way to the end. We want to break that goal down into, I like to call them progress goals. And these are small actions that we can actually take that lead up to achieving that overall end result, right?
What's an example of a progress goal?
So a progress goal, for example, with my hamstring injury, right? I would break down recovery, right? Recover from hamstring injury. We got to break that down into action steps. And so for me, that would look like each day it would be physical therapy exercises, ice leg, drink enough water, right? Like these different types of things. And progress goals to me are things I can check off when I actually did them, right? And when we can pay attention to how many of those we've kind of like piled up on top of one another, that is a great way to keep track of the progress that we've made, because although I can't say I'm recovered from my hamstring injury, I can say I've gotten a lot farther because I can look at all of those things that I've done. Another thing that I am paying attention to is strength. Right. And as my strength increases, so as I'm doing my workouts, I'm paying attention to which weights I'm using for which exercises and how many reps of them I can do. When that increases, that means I'm getting closer to my overall goal of recovery. Right. But if I was only focusing on, is my hamstring 100% better, then I would have accomplished nothing by now.
And so this idea of continuous progress, that can be hard to adapt, that mindset, especially with what we talked about, like this whole kind of, I don't know, consumer-based culture, this like want, need kind of get culture. How do you advise folks to kind of adapt that mindset?
I personally, for me, and the way that a lot of my clients find the most helpful is writing about it. So journaling, it doesn't have to be super long form, but getting the thoughts out of the brain and onto paper helps us a lot because we're actually able to see it. And then we can organize them a little bit better, right? And when we can organize those thoughts, whether it's our plan, whether it's the goals, whether it's those checkboxes, whether it's just writing about the frustration, right? It can make it feel a little bit less overwhelming, and it can make us understand where we're at in a clearer way. It gives us a clearer picture. So that way we don't feel like a failure, or it doesn't feel as daunting, right? Because when all of those thoughts are spinning in our mind, it's easy to get into that all or nothing, right? Either I won or I lost, I succeeded or I didn't. And we're usually always somewhere in the middle.
And given your recovery journey, has that impacted how you advise folks and you know, teach them?
I think it just reminded me of what it's like because this is one of those things where, you know, we can sit here and talk about it and you can be like, wow, she knows a lot about this topic. But we all experience it in the same way. You know, I'm right here with you. I'm experiencing it the same. And I think it helps me just ground into the actual experience and remember how hard it is, right? This is really hard. But it also helps me advise people to keep going, right? Because even if you gave up yesterday, like you can keep going today, right? It doesn't mean like, oh, I failed. I gave up on my goal. I didn't see my results quickly enough. So now I'm just going to give up and I'm going to start over or just not start over. It doesn't have to be like that, right? We can pick back up at any time. You can keep making progress at any time. And so I think it has just been a not so fun, but very good reminder.
Maggie Fitzpatrick, always fun with you. Thank you for being here. She's the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. Her Moving Toward Health column is in the paper today, and you can pick that up on newsstands or go to scdemocratonline.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, romance cover artist Sharon Spiak. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll take a voyage to the bottom of the sea. Also, the new exotic sounds of vibraphonist Mark Riddle, and from Sweden, Ixtawela, on their album Call of the Islands. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Why not join me where the music's shaken, not stirred? The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union. And Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sharon Spiak is a renowned romance novel cover artist with a career spanning decades. And just in time for Valentine's Day, she's exhibiting her work at a new space from Nonetta Hall. It's called Hall Space in Eldred. And the exhibit is The Story of a True Romance. And guess when it opens? Valentine's Day. And Sharon is here to tell us a little bit about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit more about your career. Now, you're a romance novel cover artist. Tell us about this artistic journey and how it began for you.
Ah, it's
It started in the early 80s. And I'm sorry.
Just come a little closer to the mic, Sharon.
Oh,
there you go. Yeah, tell us a little bit more. It started in the early 80s. You were a fashion illustrator, and then you kind of started creating book covers?
Yes, I was a student at FIT, and I really thought I was going to go into the fashion business. But I met some people who were art representatives, and they saw my fashion illustrations and said, oh, do some more work, and you know, we'll see what we can do with that. And so I did, and they introduced me to a very famous illustrator of romance novels, Pino Daiani.
And you worked with him, and how did that approach your work, your art? And
well, it was everything. His English wasn't so good at the time because he was new here from Italy. And so he would take me along to all of his meetings with the art directors, and I was his girl Friday. I did everything for him. And I just learned the business and started developing my own portfolio.
And, you know, we're talking about romance cover novels, right? These
yes.
are, these are kind of these iconic images. How do you describe these to people that they have these grand, like, sort of approaches to romance?
Well, it's basically women's,
like a fantasy?
Fantasy. It's women's fantasy. And they all have happy endings. And and it's always, you know, a rake or a medieval knight, or it goes on like that. So it's a very romantic notion, and it really fit in with my whole love of costume, and It just worked well for me.
What was it like to see your work gracing the covers of these best-selling novels in this romance genre?
It was really wonderful. And when I was doing it, which was a long time ago, this is a retrospective show.
Yeah.
And there's going to be about 50 paintings in the show, so everyone should go and see it. We have a photo shoot first.
Oh, someone can come in and like kind of pose,
we hired top notch models from the biggest modeling agencies in New York City.
Oh, when you were doing the art, you mean?
Yes. But
so you would have an actual subject there,
yeah,
to paint off of
a photo shoot,
yeah,
and then work from the photos right after.
And talk a little bit about some of the collaborations. You collaborated actually with someone who's famous for gracing some of these covers, Fabio.
Yes, everybody in the world knows who Fabio is. It's incredible. But yeah, I was one of the first illustrators to paint him before he was famous.
And, you know, traditionally you worked hand-painted these, is that right?
Yes, they're all paintings, oils. They're all oil paintings.
And now the industry is kind of gone on to become more digital.
There are no oil paintings anymore. It's all photography, which I still do costuming for.
Yeah. How do you feel about that transition?
Oh, it's fine. Yeah. I had enough of the painting them. I painted several hundred of them. So it's time to move on.
Do you have advice for anyone who's starting out in, well, young artist? And maybe, you know, you didn't go into this thinking, oh, I'm going to be this type of artist designing these things for the specific genre. But for someone who's starting out, what would you say to them? Like, keep an open mind?
Absolutely. And it's a whole different world today. It's all digital, Photoshop and AI now, I guess. It's a very different world, and nobody paints them anymore. But there's still an art involved in it, and they have to put it all together digitally. So,
but would you advise folks to still learn that hand?
Oh yeah,
part of it.
There's nothing replaces the hand art, I don't think.
And I mentioned, and we talked about your show, The Story of a True Romance, opening reception Valentine's Day from 4 to 7 at Hall Space by Nonetta in Eldred off the Route 55. And it's a retrospective. Tell us a little bit more about The Story of a True Romance, for folks can see.
Well, I was in love with the whole thing. There used to be conventions and... thousands of women would go to these conventions, and they were so much fun. And I met a lot of authors. The authors were, they used to write to me, and they requested me because I actually read the book and found a scene in the book and illustrated it, a real scene in the book. And they recognized that.
And you'll see some of those at your show with the Story of a True Romance on Valentine's Day. Did you ever get tired of Valentine's Day being a romance cover art? Not
No, I love Valentine's Day. I think Valentine's Day is a great day.
Well, again, Sharon Spiak is going to be at Hall Space. That's the new space by Nonetta. You may remember Nonetta as Nonetta and Friends. It's a new space on State Route 55 in Eldred. There's more information at hallspaceny.com. And there's much more about Sharon and her art at sharonspiakart.com. It's S-P-I-A-K. Is how you spell the last name. And you can, when you go on, you'll see these visions of these shirtless men, and these women, and these wonderful stories that show a great fantasy that's amazing, the work that you do. Sharon Spiak, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Well, happy Valentine's Day to you too.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that tonight we'll have another of our music documentaries from the BBC celebrating Black History Month. It is Donny Hathaway, and that's tonight at 9 after you hear Mr. Kusar Grace at 7 as we celebrate Black History Month. And also a reminder that the local edition is tonight at 6 with Jason Dole, and we'll be talking more about local news, culture, and NPR. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, SullivanCatskills.com, Catskill Brewery, brewing ales, lagers, and mixed fermentation beers in a LEED Gold certified building, plus a food truck and beer garden at Exit 96 off Route 17 in Livingston Manor. CatskillBrewery.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Ari Shapiro with NPR. If you've been thinking about helping this station with a contribution, but now is not the right time for a financial gift, you can donate a vehicle you don't need. Pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Think about it, and thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, running backs used to be the NFL's biggest stars, but now their salaries are near the bottom.
Why are my boys being paid less when these quarterbacks, who aren't nearly as tough as running backs, are being paid more?
But does this year's Super Bowl, featuring the Philadelphia Eagles' Saquon Barkley, represent a running back renaissance?
I don't think so.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, cloudy today, tonight, and tomorrow. We will see a high today of 28, tonight's low 13. And then tomorrow, we're watching for a potential winter storm. Snow showers developing in the afternoon and a high near 30. Periods of snow in the evening tomorrow night will transition to a wintry mix overnight. Winds up to 15 miles an hour and snow and ice accumulating 1 to 3 inches. National Weather Service says that rain and freezing rain early on Thursday as well, then cloudy in the afternoon and a high of 38.
Support comes from Sullivan 180,
building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.